From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in ultimately Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development. I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice
games. And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are South by Southwest 2024 and player friction. And so if everyone's ready, for real this time, let's start.
Okay.
Opposed to all the other times we've done it, those were all fake. This is the real one.
Well, you know what? All will be revealed in time.
Yeah, it's alluding to something. Yeah, you'll hear it.
Okay. Yep, yep. Anyway,
I screwed up. We saved it. You'll hear it. It's funny.
We're definitely at that part of the of a podcast life where it's like, oh, that was all a big disaster. All right, that's content.
Yeah.
Wow, we are though.
Yeah. I know. It's like I'm a little embarrassed.
Yeah. Gosh.
All right. Top of show, most important news.
Mm-hmm. I bought a teapot.
Yeah.
Excuse me. You did not give the right context.
I bought a new teapot.
That's not the adjective we're looking for.
I bought a $200 teapot.
There we go.
What you need? What is this thing?
Okay. I have the link. It's the Skag EKG Pro Electric Kettle.
Oh, man. That dumb name makes it even better.
Okay. It's a nice color.
Yeah.
It's like it's a smoke green and maple.
Uh-huh.
Oh. Wow.
And it connects to Wi-Fi.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
You're just making things up now.
No, I'm not. It's part of the thing. I wouldn't be paying. If this thing didn't connect to Wi-Fi, that would be, I probably would do that still. I would still maybe buy a fancy kettle if it didn't connect to Wi-Fi. But I think one of the main reasons why I got this thing is because, like, you can set it so that, like, it'll have, like, hot water ready for you at a certain times of the day.
Yeah.
And so I could wake up and then I'd be like, I'm tired. I don't want to do anything. And then I'll have nice hot water that I could immediately make tea with.
Right.
That just sounds very appealing to me. I got a pretty good tax return. So that's part of why I'm going into it.
Oh, I have a segue. I filed an extension this year from
tax. Oh.
Because I've been sick all month.
Yeah.
And we're out of town for 2 weeks. And then my next 3 weeks were a disaster. And listeners will hear me talk. And you can hear my voice still. I'm not fully, it's 2 weeks past that last recording.
Yeah.
And I'm still like getting my way back to better. It's very annoying. But all this is like tax time's coming up. And I tend to do my taxes like a week before. Mm-hmm. Like, because it takes me like 2 days to do them, which is kind of a lot, actually. It's like a full working day.
Yeah.
And then like I leave a couple things for one more day. Like I need to do this better. But I'm never that nervous about the deadline. It's always like, as long as there's a couple days left, I'll be able to handle it all. No big deal. Because I keep pretty good records. Mm-hmm. I just should be better about being able to find them when it's time.
Sure.
But this time, I just was like, there were like events going on.
Yeah.
My grandma's 90th birthday, which I had to go to and then wave at her from across the room because I was still sick.
Still sick. Yeah.
And she's 90 years old.
Yeah.
And so just like a bunch of things piled up. And I was like, you know what? I wonder if I could like, and then I'm like, oh, right. You can apply for an extension, no questions asked, mm-hmm. any American citizen, mm-hmm. and then you get till October.
Dang, I didn't know you got till October.
Wow.
Yeah. And I guess that just, it's too complicated to administer any kind of like approval process. So they just, but culturally, tax day is the April 15th. And so that is a strong enough thing that people generally don't file for an extension.
Yeah.
Also, it is not that hard to do your taxes for most people. Mm. But yeah, I just needed more time and I got it. Now the question is am I going to do it before July? Like I should, right?
I mean, probably.
But I'm going to be busy till then, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You're always going to be busy. There's no good time.
I know, it sucks.
There's just a worse time, and now is a worse time.
Ultimately, if I just do it in October, those 2 days before that deadline, I'll be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really stupid, but...
Yeah, well, that's probably what you'll do then.
Yeah.
Thank you for distracting everyone from my large purchase.
Yeah.
Oh, no, we're going to post the link to that on the website.
Yeah, we're not done with that.
Good, good, great.
We want to hear on the Discord if this is a reasonable use of your tax return money.
Most certainly is.
I want to know.
Nicegames.club/Discord. Please jump in there and tell us about your silly purchases.
Ooh, yeah.
What sharper image item are you a little bit embarrassed, but also pretty proud of owning? I want to hear it.
I have like 50 houseplants.
Yeah.
That's me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
that's mine.
That's true.
Yeah, I don't know. I would call that a different class of derangement.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Ellen, you're almost caught up on the GDC episodes.
Yeah. So
you've been listening to them?
I have been listening to them. It's been great. I
I love listening to podcasts while I do stuff. Mm-hmm. Nice. And so it's been cool to hear about all you guys' GDC adventures.
Yeah.
Good to know our podcast still holds up.
Yep.
After all these years.
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. You're right there in the podcast queue. Sometimes you're above This American Life.
Wow.
Right? I'm not saying that's necessarily a global preference for everyone. I'm just saying that I haven't listened. Yeah, so I made a last minute call not to go this year, because obviously recent job change, we've been talking about that, and there's just a lot of flux, and it just was too stressful to try to balance everything. So yeah, that kind of bums me out. I was really hoping to go this year. I'll make some other conferences hopefully. Mm-hmm. Also this year, like, I would like to go to Serious Play Conference again this year. That was really great last time.
And yeah,
it's in Toronto again this year, so I'll probably go.
Ooh.
I won't stay at it. I will not cheap out on the hotel.
Yep.
Yep. But yeah, so I mean, it sounds like it was actually, I really love listening to Dale talk about her take on it, because
Dale really decided to be a full guest host, and really, and she took a lot of notes at the talks she went to. I'm really, really proud of her for stepping up, because like she was coming along and she had a press badge with the rest of us, but we didn't give her the expectation that she was going to be part of the recordings,
right,
or needed to provide a lot of content or analysis or insight.
Yeah.
And then like when there was the space to fill, she stepped up and did it. So I'm glad that you found that she was a worthy temporary replacement, because I felt the same way.
Yeah. No, it was really cool to hear her perspective on it. And she has such a process-driven mind that it's interesting to hear her like make sense of this, the different stories and case studies that she went and listened to for the different talks. It was good. And like, really, you guys all just did a whole bunch of cool stuff. It was a lot to take in.
Yeah,
I mean, just through listening of it, like, and then like, okay, here's the next day. It's 11:59 p.m. and we're recording.
Yeah,
okay, that sounds about right.
We were kind of worried, like, oh, we'll definitely have enough for an episode. We always do. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe we'll do two this year, and like, maybe we'll do two, and then we ended up having three long episodes.
Yeah.
Plus 40 minutes of bonus material. Patreon.com/NiceGamesClub.
Mm-hmm.
You can get stuff. So, you know, 4 hours of stuff.
Yeah.
Which it was kind of overwhelming, actually, but I thought we did okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We got a lot done.
Mm-hmm.
And even outside of just our, you know, the podcast, we still got a lot of stuff done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You guys all had some meetings. You talking about Sledgehammer Bride?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm super hyped about that.
Very hyped.
You won't hear anything about that for months, though. So
yeah,
you know, I'll keep y'all in the loop.
Yeah,
you know, of course.
I assume that we will hear immediately if anything happens.
Oh yes.
So
definitely.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And now the only other thing I'll share on that topic is now I look at my GDC 2022 water bottle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is the best water bottle I own. It keeps things cold so long.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, ugh, 2022, so out of date.
Did we talk about that in the show?
Yeah, I'm like, I need to get some new dated merch.
Yeah.
New dated merch.
Yeah.
So funny.
2025. 2025 is a good number, though. It's like that nice 25.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Quarter of 100.
Mm-hmm. You say that, but in 2026, it's going to seem like an old number.
Yep.
Maybe I will have grown as a person by then. And it won't be so superficial.
Yeah.
Anyway. I should just get like stickers. That would be the thing. You get like a GDC 2022 and then you add 2023, 2024 over the sticker. Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be the right way to do it. I'm almost caught up. I think I only have the third one to listen to.
Cool.
So that one, from where we're sitting, calendar math related, I think that was the one that was released last week. So
Yeah.
I'll listen to that on the drive back to Duluth, I think.
Yeah, that one's good because you did record our bumpers around those ones. And so you'll finally actually get to hear the interviews.
Yeah, that was a lot of, cool.
That's how the sausage is made.
Yeah.
All right, well, we have a note here that there was a fire in the office here where the clubhouse is located. But you know what I'm going to do, just for funsies, because it is off topic, and we've talked enough about random things and teapots.
Mm.
Let's hold off on that one. We'll talk about that in a future episode.
So okay.
Listeners, it's an exciting tease. There was a fire in the building.
Yep.
And there's fallout, and it's a whole story. You'll hear about that in 2 weeks.
Okay.
All right, we'll get into the topics. Mine is first. This is basically, we talked a little bit about our GDC episodes. Mm-hmm. In a weird confluence of timing, you may remember I talked about going to South by Southwest, which I did the week before GDC.
Yeah.
And the idea is that then we would do a little recap episode or topic or something with it. It was a little bit of a trial to see, like, you know, we got a press badge there. I'm going to go. We're going to see if it's worth talking about on this program. So it was just a test to see if it would be something we could talk about on the program.
Right.
And that is what it was. But the timing was such, and we had three GDC episodes.
Yeah.
And we had that interview with Laura Underwater that we had recorded before mm-hmm. that has just been sitting around waiting to be released. And mm-hmm. that finally, we put out that finally.
Yeah.
And so it was just like, well, this is never going to be timely.
Yeah.
But let's talk about it. I want to talk about what I saw at South by Southwest, which is over a month ago now.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting conference, if people aren't familiar. It's in Austin, it started out as a music festival, and when I was working in radio, when I was in college, we would send people out every year, because it was basically just tons of showcases. Mm. So you could see like 25 concerts of up-and-coming bands in a week, right? Oh. You could see four of them a night, all the tiny venues and bars and stuff around the area.
Yeah.
And they'd be showcases put on by record labels and A&R people and trying to promote, and, you know, press would go. And that's how one of the venues that a band could get attention. Mm. The world has definitely changed in those 20 years.
Right.
But that's still what people do at South by, is they go for these showcases to discover new bands.
Okay.
It then evolved. It became a film festival as well. And I think at this point, it's as much a film festival as any other regional film festival. And because the event is so big, it also is the site of some pretty high-profile premieres. Mm-hmm. It's not as big a film festival as, say, like Sundance or Telluride or Tribeca or any of the really like big, famous American film festivals.
Sure.
But it'll get the same kinds of premieres as events like that.
Yeah.
In terms of its scale, it's actually closer to what we have here in the Twin Cities. MSPIF, which is actually going on right now we record this.
Huh.
That's a little bit beside the point. And then on top of the film festival, it's also like a tech convention, which is like the weirdest thing that it is.
Combo. Yeah.
And the tech convention part, because there's money involved and promotion in a way that's different from the film and music worlds, that has kind of taken over the identity of South by Southwest. If you hadn't heard of it, or you're a younger person, you might think of it first as a tech convention.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where you'll see lots of demos, and people will like promise vaporware products that never show up. And, you know, the future of X will always show up there.
Of course.
You know, and a lot of it was VR in like around 2016, when that was a bandwagon that tech people really jumped onto.
Yeah.
That supercharged the presence of the sort of the tech sector, because it was arts and tech.
Yeah.
It wasn't just apps, right?
Yeah.
But so that was a thing that juiced it a little bit, but it still is any kind of tech investor nonsense, and, you know, would go on to, you know, whatever buzzword is handy, metaverse or NFTs or all the things that like come and go and are basically nothing. Mm-hmm. And then AI is the one this year that's right. Like there's an AI angle on everything. And like, you know, you can be really cynical about all that stuff, and I think you really should, but there's also like, everyone's got to throw things at the wall and see what sticks.
True. Mm-hmm.
So like, it's not, and when you have a conference for that kind of thing, it's not surprising. It's like inundated with a bunch of people trying to like hit on the, you know, so
yeah.
I'm trying to maintain some objectivity and not just like dismiss all of it, but mm-hmm. all of it is kind of nonsense. I will say. So that's a big part of it. And that is essentially, that's the angle by which we got a press badge.
Yeah.
Is because, you know, we are tech adjacent. Also, there is gaming. I say gaming, but gaming means the word. There's games at South by. It's not, and I'll talk about that. But the other thing it is, it's a conference. So there are talks and panels, and very similar to something like a GDC, and the kind of thing that I like to go to. There's you know, they take over the convention center as well as a bunch of different venues for showcases and stuff like that. So it is a bunch of things at once. It's very, very strange because of that. But it was kind of interesting. And I only went for a couple of days. I didn't go because I just tried to get the cheapest flights in and out on the days that made sense. And then, you know, timing with what we were planning for the next week. So I tried to make the most of the time I had there. And I saw a lot of stuff. So I'm going to go through a bunch of it. I suspect this might run a little long. I didn't want to devote a whole episode to this, but this might be a little bigger than a normal topic.
Okay.
But we'll see what we get into. But some really interesting stuff. So the first thing that I want to talk about is the Creative Industries Expo. So at GDC, there's the expo, right? The show floor.
Right.
And we talked about that a lot in the GDC episodes. And if you've ever been to a conference or a convention, there will be like the floor where like there are booths and this sort of thing. And that's what this is.
Yeah.
And it's very similar, in fact, not that different of a character than the GDC floor is, but it's very, this is tech industry stuff. It is, I would say, a lot of people, and maybe this is true for a lot of things like this, but I think particularly at South By, because of the different audiences, and it feels a little afterthought-y. Like walking through it, you can kind of, people like, they kind of pin their hopes and dreams on their like new startup or something,
okay,
or the thing they're demoing, and they buy a booth space and they don't have a lot of money to put up a banner. And I feel like they're really wasting their time and money because it there was something kind of sad about it in a way that's not as sad at other, but I sort of generally feel that way about show floors, is they tend to be, for participants, it probably ends up being not as effective as you think it is.
Yeah.
Because the whole idea of a trade show, which is kind of where this comes from, is kind of an outdated idea. Like,
yeah,
we have websites now. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't need to, you can learn about products a lot of different ways. You don't have to go to the Las Vegas CES or, Comdex or whatever it was that would show off a thing where you would actually learn about the existence of something.
Yeah.
You can find out any other ways. You could search for things you're interested in. Right,
yes.
It, just the world is so different now. And I think that's obvious, but like we still hang on to these kinds of ideas. And anyway, in this context, it was very strange. So a couple of the two things I want to talk about that I saw there was there was actually this VR demo that I tried. Someone was showing off this prototype haptics controller, which was sort of interesting, but I mention it, and I don't want to mention the name of it because it was a very bad demo.
Okay.
And it kind of ties into what I was thinking about. This is like I think they got something ready to go, and then they wanted to show it off. And this, I think, there's a lesson in here for game developers and for like things like when you're pitching, or when you're, you know, we talk about playtesting, about as soon as you're ready to show something, show it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's like a fundamental belief of, you know, of the show and of our community.
Yeah, right.
Now, when it comes to that, that's one thing.
Right.
But I think that attitude can be really dangerous when it comes to the point where you actually you slap a logo on it, or you put it in front of an investor or something like that.
Yeah, that's different.
And, you know, when we talked with Midwest Games, and when you talk to a lot of publishers, they will kind of say, like, we don't really, it doesn't have to be polished or whatever, mm-hmm, but we kind of know better.
Yeah,
like,
I definitely know better now.
Yeah. In this case, the demo was, I just think that they as soon as they could get it in the schedule lined up, and I think it was a mistake because the actual physical device, you know, it's a prototype device, the 3D printed parts, which is neither here nor there.
Yeah.
That actually doesn't seem to be a barrier as far as I'm concerned, especially if you're hoping to sell to an investor and then manufacturing can be worked out later. But the thing like pinched my hand, and it was caught on my hand. They had to shut it down to dislodge it from my fingers.
Ow.
So like that's the bearing the lead, but that's what happened. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, and the software they used like was a kind of a first person shooter kind of demo that didn't showcase what they were doing very well.
Yeah.
Like they would have been much better off showing a more simple, like Fruit Ninja style thing,
mm-hmm,
or just tech demo where you just, here's the feature, here's what it does, rather than trying to integrate it into a game environment because it wasn't a fun game.
Yeah.
And so just a lot of lessons for like how you present these things. I think there's biting off more than you can chew is kind of the lesson, I think. And like evaluate what you have and what you want to show. And if this is the time to show it, and because you have to wait another year and it's a little too early, then scale your pitch to what you have rather than the promise of what you want to deliver, because it is so easy to, you see like, oh, this seems really interesting. Oh, it's a different approach, way to do this. And I try it, and I'm like, oh, they're 100 years from being able to make this promise work.
Yeah.
Like I'm uninterested in listening to the rest of that they have to say. And that can really sink you.
Yeah.
And I was trying to offer some feedback about like, here's why my experience was bad. But you know, it's too late for them to act on that kind of thing.
Right.
But I was trying to be helpful, but there was a lot of like, but this, it'll work this way and this. And I'm like, that's not going to help. Like when you try to like qualify those things. Mm. And because I wasn't a target for their investment, I was trying to make that clear. Like I would like to help you for when you do demos in the future, like this is why this happened. And if you can't fix this, then don't rely on that for the thing. And it was an interesting conversation, and I hope they took some of it to heart, but like, it is a kind of a bummer. And I've had that experience where I've shown off something that's like buggy or doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then you kind of, right, you know, this, the stakes have always been a lot lower in the cases where that's happened to me.
Yeah.
But like, it's amazing how easy it is to, waste your time and money, because it's like, it's really hard to learn these lessons without wasting your time and money.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the other lesson is like, if it happens, well, now you know, right? And it was a material loss, but there you go. And that's kind of the experience I had a lot. That was the only direct experience with that, but it's kind of the impression I had for a lot of the things here. It was like, oh, people are just here because it's South by, not because they actually really are ready to show a thing.
Yeah.
Which was sort of interesting.
That is interesting. Like, if you're just kind of doing test runs of your idea, there are tons of local events.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where you want to fail.
Yeah. I mean, like, failure doesn't always necessarily indicate a waste of effort, because you can learn from your failure.
Yeah.
But like, you have to be open to learning from it in order for that learning to happen. And if you aren't open to learning from your failure, then it was wasted effort.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So
The other thing I shot at the expo that was interesting was the Just Play showcase. So this was interesting to me because it was a game jam I'd never heard of. Called the Just Play Game Jam. And this was very specifically like, oh, this is way up our alley. I talked to some of the organizers there and, like, you know, maybe we'll reach out to them for an interview at some point in the future, because it was a really interesting project. It's Just Play, a game jam for justice.
Clever.
Yeah. So the idea is that they solicit games that focus on issues of racial justice and underrepresentation. Cool. And that's all great. And then it's an itch jam, infrastructure for it, but it's a juried competition, with a $10,000 grand prize.
Oh.
And one of the big pitches for the jam, which, would have been interesting to hear before, was that what the finalists are then displayed in this booth at South by. So that's what I wandered into.
Oh.
It's like, these are the winner. And it was a really they have sponsors. It's, you know, it was a really incredibly well put together thing. You know how, like, Dale was talking about how elaborate the booths are at GDC and how that sort of surprised her.
Yeah.
This was not quite the scale of a Unity booth, but it was like much more involved and much more polished.
Right.
They brought in their own carpet. You know, they had custom displays and furniture and stuff.
Cool.
That kind of thing. And so I was actually really curious about, like, how the funding sources and stuff like that. But also, it was a little bit of a strange environment for it, because I think if E3 were still around, that's what you'd want. You'd want to do something like that at an E3 or a more public kind of thing. That's because the Creative Industries Expo, even though South by is a convention, the expo is much more for the conference goers.
Sure.
Right. So I don't think so. It was an interesting thing. So that's one thing that sort of struck me as curious about it.
Yeah.
But also really, like, thinking about my feelings about juried competitions. Because one of the things that's very valuable about it in this case is that it, especially because it's a showcase opportunity and, a grant award for the winners, that is important, because it's about showcasing games that have stories that are not usually told in commercial spaces. And it rewards that, and also the types of people who make those types of games. And are developers who are underrepresented, and so that's really valuable. But part of me still runs up against the idea of it being a public competition, which I really, really struggle with, because I don't like the idea of that. And I think, well, if the point is to offer a certain number of opportunities to showcase, you kind of do need a rubric or a criteria for that, right? You need something like that. But part of me thinks that it would be more responsible to do that as a closed grant application process rather than as a public competition. But then would you get a lot of buy-in from participants? And how do you... So there's I don't like it, but at the same time, I have to understand there are practicalities to it in a lot of ways that can give beneficial results. But also, like, is $10,000 as a grant, that's not enough to start a career with,
right?
But that's still a lot.
Yeah.
But would that be better done as, you know, five $2,000 awards, you know? And these are all conversations I'm sure this group has had, right? This is all, and it's something I would want to talk to them about if we had any of them on the show. But I did speak to one of the organizers for a long time the thing, and it was really just like the sort of the pure, sort of motivation behind it, like, was really impressive to me.
Okay.
And so I would love to see this get bigger and evolve. And whether it, you know, whether it remains a juried competition or not is sort of beside the point for that hope of mine for it, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was really, really fascinating. And to just come across it in a thing where I talked about this before I went, and even when we talked about it briefly during our GDC shows, like, South by, it's game content is kind of nebulous. And yeah. So it was interesting to see something there that like, and then when I talked to them and saying like, oh, I'm going to GDC next week. And they're like, yeah, it's crazy. That's coming up so soon. And I was like, why aren't you at GDC?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Because if you're trying to, especially if you're trying to change the attitude about what gets funded, what gets showcased, what gets shown in front of the industry, GDC would be a better showcase. But then, you know, South by is cooler.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
that, you know, and also like maybe that it was easier for them to do. Maybe they had more connections and made that possible. Whereas maybe, so again, I've lots of questions. It seems like a really, really cool effort. And I really just want to know more about it because this specifically and this kind of thing, I think it would be great to see if we had a lot of it because then you could do it in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. Right. Cause the way I'm describing it, it's almost like I'm kind of putting a lot of burdens on its shoulder to do it, you know, to optimize how it does it. But like, if there were 10 of these, you know, at this scale with the sponsorships that they've been able to secure, like that would be a great thing for the industry.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
Cause I think we talk a lot about how the importance for this topic is a real bottom up approach.
Yeah.
Like you can't make games that are more inclusive and teams that are more inclusive by having a bunch of, you know, the executive suite decide they're going to do that.
Yeah.
Right. You actually have to funnel in those people into the community from the bottom up.
Right.
So that those are the people who are making games.
Yep.
Right. I think that top down approach is not something you should shy away from, but it's like you can't, that's not the only way. That's not the only part of the solution.
Yeah.
And too often it's presented as the only part of the solutions that mm-hmm. companies will offer.
Mm-hmm.
So the ecosystem of games and game development and all of that, seems like a sort of a necessary thing. Anyway, it was really neat. And I have tons of questions. And I would love to hear and talk more about it in the future.
Yeah.
And I didn't see that much else interesting at this expo. So
okay.
I did take some notes, but I'm like, meh, and the rest of it's just, you know, neither here nor there.
Sure.
I was talking about a couple of talks that I did go to at the conference.
Okay.
One of them was on a related topic. It was called How Design Thinking Protects White Supremacy.
Oh.
And this is design thinking from like product design. So this is outside of games.
Okay.
Design thinking is a specific philosophy that you can look up. We can provide a link in the show notes about what that is. But it's a pretty storied, well understood and well-respected process for designing user experiences. The upshot of this talk that I really found valuable was that it was basically just conferring a message on participants that something we've talked a little bit about, where and they phrase it in this way. They say there's no such thing as neutral design, mm-hmm. right? And they say that design is a political act,
yeah.
right? And these are very provocative ways to say what we've said on the show a lot, which is that there's no decision you could make. There's nothing you can't. Everything you do is a decision,
yes.
right? Every choice you make makes a choice.
Yes.
It's really obvious when you say it that way. But like, there's no way you can not have an opinion on something in your work. And that's they phrase it. There's no such thing as neutral design, and so you have to know what you're saying. And that was really valuable to hear from that perspective because I think that is where it is needs to be most like shouted at people, frankly.
Yeah.
When it comes to notions of protecting institutional racism, sexism, from that perspective in a way that you wouldn't necessarily expect. And I don't want to speak for the presenters because I think we'll just share some links and there's a bunch of book recommendations I had as well. But just generally, I think it aligns a lot with what we talk about in a more broad sense that can apply to any particular topic.
Yeah.
But in particular, this topic is one that I think people need to be like, they need to be told this.
They need to be aware of it.
Yeah. And like the rest of it you can learn, but this I think is urgent in a sense. And I'm glad that they presented it as a way that was sort of a urgent kind of like, this is wake up. This is, you know, the longer we let it go on, you know, as a game designer, if you're, you know, not realizing the choices you're making are having impacts on the work you're doing, so it goes, right? Yeah. That reduces your ability to express yourself as a designer. But when those choices perpetuate institutions of racism or sexism or oppression, mm-hmm. and you're not aware that you're doing that, that is an urgent concern, right? And that happens a lot more when it comes to things like, you know, systems design, things like government websites and, you know, stuff like that. And so they showed a couple of examples of people doing good. I think the one critique I would have of their talk is because both of the presenters, they run consultancy firms.
Oh, okay.
So there was a little bit of a kind of like a, this is how you do it. And call us if you want to do it. And it's like, I can't really fault them for that necessarily because they do really good work, right?
Yeah.
And you know, they deserve all the clients they can get. But I think it did limit the conversation a little bit to that kind of a on that dimension. But that's kind of a South By thing. Everyone is there to sell something. It's very different from other conferences I've been to, in that there's a lot more hustle involved in the presenters. A lot more people are presenting, not so much a topic as here's how what I do can address this topic.
Yeah.
In a way that sort of feels a little bait and switch sometimes. It wasn't the case here necessarily, but I was reminded, because this was very early in the my time there. I was like, oh right, this is what I'm in for. Right. And this is the sort of most benign version of that. I was like, oh, right. Okay. I can't get too cynical about this sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, they're here to promote as on an idea as well as themselves.
Sure.
And this one did a better job of presenting the idea. But there was still that angle there.
Yeah.
Another thing I went to was a thing for from Intel, and I have a lot of opinions on Intel as a company that is independent from like the processors they make or whatever.
Sure.
And it's because I saw a keynote of theirs at CES in 2015 that really inspired me, but I was also very skeptical of, where they made a huge public commitment to hiring diversity in a way that was, in 2015, made headlines and also really rolled people's eyes, because they're like, really? Are you really going to do that?
Yeah.
And then, interestingly, and we'll put some links in the show notes on this, but one of their particular goals, they had many as part of that, but one of them was that they were going to start, in terms of their suppliers, like the contractors they work with, in the whole ecosystem of the company, because it's an enormous company, right?
Yeah.
So when they hire contractors and suppliers and vendors, they were like, we're going to commit to a much greater diversity in terms of like Black-owned businesses, women-owned businesses. That's just something that we're going to put money towards that effort.
Yeah.
And they beat their target by 8 years on that. They were like, we're going to do this by such and such date, and they just smashed it. And this is one of the things that is interesting for Intel as a company, because it's a privilege of scale. A company like Intel, with the right leadership, can make that commitment and put that money towards it. And that's not, their shareholders are not going to revolt.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But a smaller company, where that they're going to commit resources to something that is, they say, this will help the company in a way that is, that requires you to have a political alignment in order to even believe is true. Right. And it rocks the boat in a certain way, and it's money now towards towards an institutional improvement in the future. Mm-hmm. That's something that Intel, it's a privilege of scale. And it's really interesting, because we talk a lot about, especially if you're a leftist, politically, which, you know, shocker I am, it becomes kind of uncomfortable to say, like, well, it is kind of the big, big companies that can really move the needle on a lot of these things. Mm. And it really isn't so much. There are certain things that are systemic, right? And then I think there's definitely a lot of history on the left of thinking of things as really like, and we talk, I mean, bottom up, right?
Yeah.
We talk about a lot of things, right? That need to be bottom up, and that's as true as ever. But at the same time, in order for those big things to happen, sometimes you actually do need like big bets by innovative leadership.
Sure.
Which is, it's this contradiction. It really, it very much flies against what we were talking about earlier. But like, and it becomes really hard to trust, because you think of like, well, if you're up there, then what are you thinking of other than profit motive? And it's like, well, if you have more money than you know what to do with, then you go looking around for other motives. And because most people are good, like, you kind of might stumble onto to using that power for good. It's like a weird sort of anti-dystopian kind of thing, and it certainly doesn't always happen.
Yeah,
but sometimes it happens.
Yeah,
and it's very weird. Anyway, that's a huge preamble, because the talk I went to was about font.
Okay.
Oh.
I was looking in your notes.
Yeah,
where is this written?
It's,
I'm
all
not seeing any of
wild.
This.
Okay.
You guys know everything is everything.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is.
I guess I should have seen it.
Prove it, Mark.
So Intel One Mono is a monospace a font. It's open source.
Mm-hmm.
It's meant for developers, and it's meant for low vision developers.
Oh, okay.
So they really, a big key of it. Now, there's been a move in the last 10 years. One, because font development is much more democratized than it used to be.
Yeah.
It's no longer the purview simply of like, you know, foundry companies. Now actual graphic designers can do it. And every company's got a lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
So people can be good at it with some training. And so there's been this movement to replace Courier, right?
Yeah. Okay.
To make a monospace fonts that are better in legibility and aesthetic, and different, you know, reasons for different things, or like really good at small sizes with great hinting, or just like beautiful. So if you're an aesthete, and all of this stuff. And this is part of that movement, but basically it was interesting because they were just focused on legibility and not in a broad sense. Because I think hearing them talk, it made me kind of realize like, oh, right, a lot of these, like, oh, we made a courier version that is like a little bit better. It's more, we think about humans more, and it's not just this, like, it's not made for typewriters. And so we can think of other things. And then when they talk about what they did with that same goal, you're like, oh, they actually did the research. They did proper testing. They abandoned conventional wisdom.
Okay.
And it's like, oh, they took it seriously.
That's good, because like there's that font that's like supposedly good for folks who have dyslexia.
Yeah.
That doesn't actually help in a lot of cases.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think a lot of these kinds of things are good intentions married with amateur efforts.
Yeah.
And when I say amateur, I don't mean that they're not professional in other ways. Mm-hmm. I mean that people will be like, I have this idea to disrupt something. Mm-hmm. And so therefore I'm going to assume I know better, and then I will just proceed. Yeah. And you know, that's be daring, be bold, be a rascal. I'm not saying never do something like that. Mm. But what I think is then you see the press on a lot of things, and then you're like, oh wait, where's the study? Where's the research that can confirm those findings?
People just saw on Twitter that this font is supposed to be better, and then people started using it.
Yeah.
And you take it as read because, like, you know.
Well, and it's good intentions because you can say fonts that are not like that are bad for dyslexia. Mm. Therefore, you know what I mean? Yeah. There's a kind of reverse logic that sometimes happens.
Yeah.
And I think there's some ignorance, too, because you kind of you think you've done it. And then Intel, again, privilege of scale. They brought in a bunch of low vision users over Zoom, and then they watched them use it.
Okay,
very nice.
And then they would interrupt them, and they would say like, okay, I see you slowed down there. Why? And then they would start to think about their using very playtesty, really familiar to me as someone who playtests games, where you actually just observe rather than just query or survey.
Right.
That was really, really fascinating. And one of the things that was so interesting is they really exaggerated the difference between glyphs. So some of the characters have serifs and some don't. And when you look at it as a full set, it is pretty aligned. It looks like a one font, right?
Yeah.
It does seem to hold together. But then they also were like, well, sometimes an N can look like an R when spacing is tight or sizes are small. So we're going to put a big ol' hanging off serif on the R, but not on the N. And like, oh, that's, of course. Like, you make the letters more different from each other, and like then legibility increases.
Yeah.
And of course, like all accessibility efforts, it provides benefits not just for people who quote unquote need it, but for everyone who could use it.
Yeah.
And I was really, really excited about that. And one of the things that was if you're a font nerd like me, one of the things that you know a lot is that a large X height. So the X height is the size of a lowercase letter, right? It's the size of an X, lowercase X.
Sure.
And then there's the full height of the character, which is like a capital I or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you've got ascenders and descenders, and you know, there's all the rules and things like that. Mm-hmm. Generally, it's thought that a large X height will increase legibility because you can open up the shapes and the counters, and you can really make, and there's more space to provide the diversity.
Okay.
And what happens above an X height tends to be low information. So you don't need as much space for that. That's kind of the theory anyway.
Okay.
And they were like, no, it turns out that's not true. No. Like, or rather, it's sometimes not true.
Oh.
And in the case where they were using, so it was really interesting how they were just like, we're going to do some testing, and then we're actually going to like challenge some conventional wisdom that's come from, you know, generations of design that had different goals, that had similar goals and could be very easily. So I was really, really sort of very impressed with this group and how they brought it together within Intel.
Yeah.
How they, you know, Intel has an open source department, but there's also people who are like, why are we doing this open source project? Why aren't we just making this font? And we don't have to sell it, but we can just give it away. Why do we have to open source it? And like, just to hear everybody on the stage talk about like, oh, we have this internal design department, but we're also working with a very well-known type foundry to assist. And just like the way they coordinated all of that. And the fact that like, everyone had time to do it. Like it was like they sort of, you know, it was like a they took people off of projects they were working on who had like an extra couple days or something. So very, again, privilege of scale, which was really, really fascinating. But the thing that really struck me the most, just from my background, that I felt they had sort of interesting perspective on was they talked a lot about color. So color is really fascinating. Anyone who knows about graphic design knows that like color contrast is interesting. And if you're a programmer, you know that the font is only one part of the story. You also have the coloration for keywords and different word types and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is generally been the purview of graphic designers or people who create themes. And that's generally not given. There's some accessibility concerns that are sort of obvious. It's a very small design space, right? Yeah. So it doesn't, you know, you don't, you kind of just, you can look at it and if it feels right, it's right. But they talked a lot about how, like, well, we looked at a lot of the different commonly sort of structured things. Like sometimes we have things with low contrast or high contrast to show the importance of different things in different themes and different IDEs. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, like, you never know what it's going to look like, right? Because every IDE has different sets and new themes are coming out all the time. But they were also trying to find, like, well, turns out when you look at the this character in this color, it looks clearer than when you look at it this color. Mm. So how are we going to design this character?
Yeah.
Because it's not just white on black or black on white. There's all these different combinations when you use an IDE. Mm-hmm. And then for low vision users and colorblind users, it's a whole other set of things. So that was super fascinating to me that they really thought about that. But also, I was really struck by their lack of tools to do much about it, right? Like, imagine different character glyphs and sets that would actually respond to different colors, right? And so one of the questions I asked during the Q&A was, because I know one of the tools that's available as part of the OpenType standard, or that the current font standards, is a variable width. So rather than just, you know, light, bold, black, you know, in terms of how thick you want, you can have a variable width.
Yeah.
And that's much more common. There's lots of fonts that do that. Adobe is leading the way on that.
Okay.
It's not widely used, but it's a web standard now as well. So you can do it. I think for game designers who really will focus on tweaking this and that, I would love to see variable width fonts make it into game engines because you have lots of aesthetic value to that as well as accessibility value.
Mm-hmm.
But also, how do you, you know, if you're in Word, like, do you really need that much control? So, you know, there's lots of, in terms of, it's not the newest font feature, but it's still working its way into sort of how we use fonts, you know. In any case, the thing I was thinking is, like, well, one of the reasons they were talking about a particular glyph is because they needed it to be a little bit heavier. And so the whole font needed to be a little heavier to account for some of the different color patterns they were seeing. It's like, well, what if you had a VS Code plugin that knew what all the keywords colors were, and then you just, you know, provided a variable width modifiers towards things like that. Mm-hmm. And like that would have to be a combination between a variable width font and then something interfacing with the IDE to be able to link those things together. So I asked about that.
Yeah.
Like, would that be something that you could do? And they were talking about how they thought about variable width, but it was just beyond the scope of their resources at the time.
Sure.
But they were kind of like, it's that thing, it's that dream you have as someone at a Q&A where someone's like, oh, that's a good idea. We're going to talk about that. So I was really pleased to have contributed that thought, because I would really love to see that.
Mm-hmm.
And not just for a font like this, but for all fonts, and for that to be sort of a standard by which you could put as part of your theme information. You know, this is the color I have, and then we have some standard, like, these colors against these backgrounds, and essentially a default modifiers, which you could then modify if you chose. Anyway, I got really excited about that, like, as someone who does graphic design, who builds content, and also makes tools.
Yeah.
Like, all of that was up my alley.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really fun.
Cool.
But the other thing that was really interesting, and I did ask about them about, is they call it Intel One Mono, because one is their branded font for, like, if you see the word Intel on a letterhead, it's in the one, Intel One.
Oh, okay.
That's their brand font, right? Lots of companies have brand fonts. It's kind of an exercise in narcissism, frankly. But, you know, big companies, a lot of money can do it.
Yeah.
So, and that'll be like a font that sometimes they won't offer publicly. It'll just be for their communications. And invariably, they're just some tweak on Helvetica, you know? I'm being cynical about it, but actually, I like this. I think it's fun that companies do this.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think that it's that big a deal.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's how this project started. It's like, let's do a monospace version of our brand font. Then people could code with it. And then the project evolved.
I see.
And it just internally, they're just like, well, what if we had a point to this? What if it was not just, you know, to extend our brand?
Yeah.
And so I asked, I said, well, once that changed, did you think, because it doesn't really look like the one font anymore so much, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it had different goals and different things. And so, like, did you ever think about changing that to be its own brand?
Yeah.
And they said, like, oh, yeah, we did, but we decided it was not worth the internal politics.
Ah.
And I'm like, oh, that is such a great answer.
Yeah.
And they were just like, it didn't matter enough to us. And we had the buy-in to start the project. Everyone was happy with how it's going. Nobody was unhappy with the way it evolved. So we didn't want to rock the boat
yep.
by yeah. saying what would be sort of obvious to someone designing a product. Like, oh, this is something different now. Let's give it a new name.
Yeah.
They're just like, well, that's okay. Let's just keep going. And I'm like, you know what? That's the responsible choice.
Mm-hmm.
It was really fascinating. So the last thing I'll say about it is you got to look at them curly brackets on this font. They are incredible. Ooh. And they're wacky is what they are. But
that's curly
because curly, they're meant to be really differentiated from square brackets.
Yeah.
In a way that a lot of fonts generally aren't. Mm. Because curly brackets are kind of ugly, and so designers tend to minimize the differences between those. They try to make them a little more subtle, a little more aesthetic. And I think it's the best example of what this font does that other fonts don't, mm-hmm. which is to say, like, our curly brackets are going to be extreme because you need them to be, or they will look like something else.
Yeah.
I've definitely been in positions where I'm like, why do I have all these errors? Oh, those are square brackets.
Yeah.
I hit the wrong button.
I've done that.
Like, what a weird thing. What a weird problem to have.
Mm-hmm.
But if, you know, this font recognizes it and said, like, you know, especially for low vision users, that's going to happen all the time. Yeah. So
I'm trying it out now. I have it on Notepad and I'm switching Notepad to this font.
Yeah. Yeah, give those curly
braces. Whoa! What?
Yep, exactly right.
That is different and exciting.
And it's a commitment to their philosophy of it, you know, which then becomes the aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I was just floored. I've talked about this for a long time, but like I was really, really impressed by that. And I think it does have lessons for game developers, particularly for tool makers, when you're thinking about your audience and like when you think about, again, just that lesson we've heard in a lot of places, like when you make things with the purpose of accessibility, you have to also think about the fact that like you're not doing it for a limited audience. You are doing it for everyone.
Yeah.
And so we'll put the link to the GitHub project in the show notes and you can download the font
mm-hmm.
and try it out for yourself. See if you like it and see if you have opinions about it. Because I think the more that these kinds of things are talked about, the more kinds of projects like this will get commissioned from other companies, which is really cool.
True.
I like the question mark too. It's like a little bit of an angle.
Yeah. Yeah, that font has opinions, and that's I like that, you know? Okay, another thing I went and saw was I saw a talk from the FCC chairperson, Jessica Rosenworcel, who is, I'm a huge fan of hers.
Mm-hmm.
She leads the FCC and has done a great job of kind of like no-nonsense progress in that agency, sort of undoing a lot of the dismantling that the last FCC regime did.
Yeah.
One of those things includes net neutrality,
yeah.
which she made a commitment to at this talk. It's not the subject of the talk, but it was nice to hear her say that because it was sort of uncertain as to how fast they were going to move on that.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, recent news, it'll probably be done by the time, it'll probably be in place by the time people hear this episode.
Yeah.
On April 25th, there'll be a vote on restoring the rules under Title II make internet providers common carriers. That's a discussion from 2015. Again, at CES, I saw a talk from Tom Wheeler when they did it the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really fun. That was cool that she mentioned that. Neat to see that thing. But the talk was about what's called the Space Bureau, which is super cool. It's a great name. It is essentially a new structure for regulating satellite communication.
Oh.
Which is really fascinating. The FCC having a remit there is really cool. There's two things you talked about. I'll try to get to this pretty quickly because it's a little bit off topic for the show. But this thing called One Network Future, it's the sort of name they're putting on it, which is this idea of encouraging companies to combine satellite networks with cell networks in order to provide greater coverage for rural internet, cool. Also greater adaptability for natural disasters,
yeah.
Things like terrorist attacks. And there's more satellite connection options in newer phones as well, but that's got to ramp up.
Yeah.
And that's also got to ramp up in the sense that you need competitors in space, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, there's lots of SpaceX satellites. It's incredible how many SpaceX satellites there are.
Oh.
It represents a sizable percentage of all space material.
Oh.
You can look into that. It's really fascinating. Mm. But like, there needs to be a regulatory infrastructure to encourage more competition in that space.
Yeah.
And that was really interesting, and just her commitment to that was really cool. And then the other thing that was really fascinating, and like, she got really riled up for it, which is like, it's great to see like a nerd in their element, and that's kind of what she looked like to me.
Yeah.
She was talking about how this idea, like, well, at the FCC, we regulate communication, right? And so that's why this is what we're regulating. But it doesn't just mean satellites. Like, there's a lot of applications for manufacturing in space, right? Put a manufacturing fabricator up there,
mm-hmm.
and then an uncrewed factory in space, and think of the savings and the abilities and the things you could produce in a zero gravity environment, right? And like, it's the kind of things that we're not imagining, but in a properly regulated system, you would have, it would be a lot less friction for companies to try things, which is interesting, which is sort of inverse of the criticism you get from regulatory regimes, is that it stifles innovation. But when it comes to something like, providing equal access to space, something that like the military has a lot of interest in putting rules on. Mm-hmm. Well, if you provide us, if you carve out areas for commercial use in a way that will encourage people to invest because they know they won't be shut down if you're going to move fast and break things, then like the government's not going to shut you down because you have a lot of like Uber had a lot of users that liked their service.
Yeah.
And that's the gamble they took, right? Yeah. So that the government wouldn't shut them down because then the public would be upset.
Yeah.
That's the little secret behind Silicon Valley disruption is like, let's not follow the law. Let's break the law, but give people something they want so that the law changes to support our use case, right? That's the sort of libertarian, dream of Silicon Valley. But in something like space, like you cannot go to space, like you can't disrupt in space.
Yeah.
So you need an environment in order for companies to take those risks. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it was really exciting to hear her talk about that. And just, she just posted some like crazy, like, here's what you might be able to do, but I don't know. And like, that's kind of cool, right?
Yeah.
Just the human innovation, right?
Yeah. Opening up avenues to try stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got confused when you were talking about manufacturing in space. I was like, how does that even... But I see what you're saying.
That's a limited imagination, Steven.
Yeah, literally, that's me. I was confused.
Beep boops.
Yeah.
Beep boops.
Beep boops.
Yeah. But even medicine manufacturing would benefit from a zero gravity environment. And it would be too expensive to do on a limited basis. But if you had something more robust, there's rockets going up and down all the time now with commercial spaceflight, which I've generally disliked. Like, mm-hmm. I don't like the commercialization of space travel. That's concerned me a lot. But I think, I was completely won over by the whole concept, but I was really turned around in a sense like, oh, I could really see the appeal of getting more players involved in that system. The thing that worried me most was the building a regulatory environment that discouraged public involvement.
Yeah.
So I did ask about that. I said, well, what about a public option, to use a phrase from the healthcare debate? Like, what if, and this wouldn't be NASA, this would be like a different public agency that would provide the same, that would compete against other private space contractors, whether that's rocket makers, or whether that's satellite developers, or whether that's any of the, whatever infrastructure gets built up. Mm-hmm. And it was nice, and she was saying that like, oh, we're definitely designing around a way that would not preclude that.
Okay.
So that was really good to hear.
Very cool.
And so, yeah, it was really cool to see. I'm nerdy stuff. I'm always super into it.
I like the intentionality of like creating legislation and creating like foundations of ways people can work together.
Yeah.
Relatively early on in the industry. I mean, space is big.
Yeah.
And I know that we've been doing space for a while now.
Yeah.
But like not, couple hundred years from now, we'll probably still be doing space. And then like it'll look back and be like, wow, we really didn't know what we were doing.
I mean, you may think it's a long way down to the corner to the chemists, but that's peanuts compared to space.
Right. Peanuts. Mm-hmm. Peanuts.
Trying to find some game content, right? Some game industry stuff.
Right. That is that kind of, that was essentially our podcast.
That was essentially the reason I went.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to talk a lot about it because there was very little.
Okay.
But there was a micro talks section where it was just a bunch of speakers talking about games thing. Okay. Video game micro talks. I'm like, great. That's my space. If I see nothing else here, at least I'll get some content. It was a total waste of time.
Dang.
And which isn't to say that all the talks were bad, but I would say 90% of the talks were bad.
Oh.
And so, which means there were only a few that were not bad.
Yeah.
But everyone is here to sell something. That was really frustrating. There was always some slide about how AI will change whatever they're doing, which is like, give me a break. And one of the things I did notice with this that struck me, which I don't see in GDC talks a lot, but I definitely see in promotional talks like these, and I would say stealth promotional talks that are not, they're not labeled as such, is they tend to like, they'll have just tons of like other people's material on their slides.
Yeah.
And they'll always have like a little attribution in the corner, like this image taken from whatever, and as if that's fine. Like as long as you credit, you can steal. Like, no, that's not how it works, folks. I mean, that's a totally small thing. It's a presentation. It's not like, but the reason that really struck me in this particular instance is there was one talk that used that did these attributions for these things and kept crediting a CDN, For folks who know, a CDN is a content delivery network. It's essentially a bunch of servers that deliver content. They're not a copyright owner. It's a piece of technology. Like, and so they just like did the minimum due diligence to find out where they got this image from.
Oh, no.
And they just checked the URL of where they pulled it from. Oh. And then said, well, that's who must own it then. And then just put that in the corner and they're like, I'm a good citizen. Like, just that kind of laziness is very endemic to the tech industry when it comes to those kinds of crossing T's and dotting I's in a way that, like, it in slides, whatever, but it was sort of play acting. I would rather them just not bother with the fake attributions then. So I was just getting angrier and angrier through this microtalks. And that's why a little thing like that got really under my skin. Mm. It's like, I cannot respect if you just sort of like are pretending to do, you know, just like be what you are. Like, don't, you know. And then, of course, there was tons of generative AI images as slides, and then like no text on those slides. I'm like, why do you even have slides? Like, if you're just meant doing it because it's a talk, it needs slides. So I'm going to put some generative images of a skyscape or something, and like,
yeah, no.
Just you don't have to do it. You don't have to, right?
Yeah,
you can leave a blank slide. That's totally fine.
Well, and you can have a slide that's just imagery, but that should be playing off of what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right. Like, then if you're going to do that, it's got to create, there has to be some sort of interesting juxtaposition between what's happening in, like, out of your mouth and what's on the screen. Otherwise, it's just vibes.
And I think that it's a little bit of, it reveals a little bit of the lie of the promise of generative AI. It's like, generative AI is great. It'll be a great tool, but it's going to be a tool for artists, and it's maybe make their job faster and easier, but it is not going to, quote unquote, democratize art, because what it's going to do, and what it might do, it might help people find their way to a journey towards product. You know what I mean? Like, any tool that makes things easier does. Mm-hmm. But when it's like, oh, someone who doesn't care about art can suddenly do art. And like, no, that's not actually how it works.
No.
If you put like something like that in a slide, like, it doesn't mean anything unless you give it meaning. And if you give it meaning, you actually have to think about it.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, then you're already spending more time than you want to do on this.
Right.
And I think just it is interesting, like the signposts of metaphor and aesthetic ends up being more important than like why we have metaphor and aesthetic, which is to talk, to communicate. And it's like, well, I have all the parts, so I'm doing the job.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm just sitting play there acting. Because none of the content was interesting at all.
Ugh.
I was sitting there just thinking about process and structure in a way, because that's my, you know, it's my jam. But it was really, really frustrating. And annoyingly, I got really mad at the organizers, because like, if you're doing a South By thing, you're going to get a bunch of hucksters. That's just what's going to happen.
Sure.
I got your AI here.
Yeah.
And got like, your bots.
And you know what? That's fine. But if you're organizing these micro talks, I'm really upset because one of the talks was like this. The title of it, I want to say as little about it as possible. I don't want people to look this up.
Okay.
But right. Like, it was from some like woo woo person, who talked about like, you know, whatever, just absolute nonsense. And about like world ending, you know, like secret cabals in control of this or that. I was like, what is going on right now? Why are we talking about this? It's because the title of their talk had the word game in it. And so they must have submitted it to the thing that had game. And then the organizer was like, didn't look at it close enough. Oh. And so this person got up and like started talking about the kind of thing you would see at, you know, like at a UFO convention, essentially. Yeah. And just sitting there thinking like, I'm like, I didn't pay for my ticket, but I did pay for my plane ticket.
Right.
Like, I was thinking like, and a lot of the other people here spent a lot of money to be in this room. And if that's the kind of programming you put on, like, I was properly offended. Mm. And here is at the games talk, which is like essentially the one thing that kind of told me that, oh, there's some gaming content.
Yeah.
So I'll go.
Yeah.
And it was the biggest waste of time. Mm. And so very, very frustrating, and thinking a lot about how South By and other things like that do get by on reputation, and like it's this big thing everyone wants to be a part of. Mm-hmm. And then so, okay, but there's not enough people talking about like, is it really actually doing its job at like earning that, or is it just skating on what it's earned? And part of it is the scale of the thing. This thing is so big, it's going to have a lot of bad stuff in it.
Yeah.
You know, stuff at the edges. And that's kind of fine, actually, but it's particularly because it was one of the very few pieces of games content that wasn't like, you know, come see our VR demo that looks like the same thing you saw in 2018, but also has a bunch of hype. Like, you know, there was still a lot of VR stuff there.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was no different than what we've seen in the past 6 years.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really frustrating because I'm glad we got a press badge and I'm glad I went, but I was really, really disappointed. And I think it's important to express my frustration at the way that they approached games. Mm. because I don't know that there's a lot of other, I don't think there's a lot of other gaming press that attends South By necessarily, if they're not covering a PR thing, like
sure.
a launch or, you know, a project or a product or whatever, but actually going that you might to actually the content that they're ostensibly for people who are interested in working in those things. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was really frustrating. Also, it's a film festival. I saw a bunch of cool things. I talked about this before I went, but the reason I wanted to go was to see, the reason that sort of finally convinced me to do it, to actually take the trip, was because they had the Star Trek Discovery premiere there. Mm-hmm. Now, this season's been going on a while. We're on episode 4 now. By the time you hear this, the most of the season will be through by now. Mm-hmm. So I have nothing to report about the episode that I got to see a couple weeks early, other than it was super fun to do. The cast was there. Cool. Wilson Cruz, who plays Hugh Culber on the show, the Doctor, he was hooting and hollering the whole time. It was like when something cool happened on screen, he was like, yeah, and everyone was clap. It was like, it was really fun. So I had a great time at a Star Trek thing, which was really, really cool.
That's cool.
Yeah. I saw a movie called Ghostlight, which was kind of a surprise to me because I wasn't expecting much from it. And the description was not accurate. And so I kind of, about 5 minutes in, I'm like, oh, this isn't what I thought it was going to be, but it was way better.
Oh, that's good. A lot of times I'll read a movie description. I'll be like, and I'll get into the movie in like 5 minutes. And I'm like, oh, this is the one I thought, and it's worse.
Yeah, and I'm too late to give this recommendation to our listeners because this will be out. But at our local convention, MSPIF, which is happening now, it's playing there too.
Oh.
And so maybe I'll drag Stephen, you or Ellen, you, or maybe I'll drag you to this.
Is
film.
It scary?
No.
Okay. Well, then all right.
No. It's a great. It's a story about a family. A man who's kind of. He's a construction worker, and he's a little bit depressed, and you kind of don't know why, but it's slowly revealed.
Okay.
And then he stumbles onto this community theater group putting on a rendition of Romeo and Juliet, like people in their 50s and 60s. Mm. And it's essentially a comedy, but it's very, I would say it's very staid. There are funny moments, but it doesn't, it's a movie that doesn't want you to laugh out loud, even though there are laugh out loud moments in it.
Yeah.
What's it called again?
A Ghostlight.
Ghostlight. I'm looking for it listed here.
And I don't want to say too much more about it because it crescendos in a way that is really, really fascinating and emotionally cathartic. Mm. And it's a story of him, and then it's about him and his daughter, and then it's about him and his family. And it like, so the scope of it gets a little wider as it goes, and you start to hear more in this little nucleus of this event that they're recovering from. You get more perspective as you go. So a lot of times a story that will revolve around a main character, there'll be like a twist or you'll learn more about it.
Yeah.
And sometimes that feels really cheap.
Yeah.
But what's good about this is that the perspective of the viewer widens as the story progresses without things in the story getting weirder and weirder,
sure.
Which is how these things normally go.
Yeah.
And anyway, I loved it. It was fantastic. And cool. It's playing here in the city, so I might want to go see it again.
Yeah.
I saw a movie called Resonator, which is a documentary about a woman who is a roadie in the music industry, and her father worked with synthesizers. Mm. And the Resonator was a thing he made and tried to get produced and sold. And it was being promoted in trade shows and stuff in the early 80s. And supposedly Peter Gabriel put in an order for one. And but then he died in a car accident very soon after his daughter was born. So she never knew him. And so the story is ostensibly about her uncovering her dad's career and what happened to this product.
Okay.
Because his untimely death was actually not why the thing was never mass produced.
Mm-hmm.
So that's essentially what the movie is about. Mm. But it then becomes more about her learning who her father was and her family. And a story like that, if you're just going for like, this is a fun documentary about a fun thing that I've never heard of, you could feel a sense of betrayal when it starts to become like emotional. You're like, it's like, that's great, but that's not what I'm here for.
Yeah.
But this movie very deftly makes that pivot without like, without throwing away what you were there to see in the first place.
Okay.
So I really respect it for that. I missed the screening for that, but with a press badge, I had access to the screening website for press people.
So,
I watched the movie on my phone in line for another movie.
Oh.
That is a very Mark thing to do.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. And then the last thing I'll talk about just about music. I only went and saw one band.
Okay.
I went through the whole schedule and I just watched, it was like 200 or something.
Yeah.
And I watched all the YouTube clips from all the bands just for 30 seconds to see if I'd be interested.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I'm going to be there. I'm not going to have anything to do at night. I'm not going with anybody. Mm-hmm. So I'll need something to do at night. And so let me just listen to a little clip of all the bands and I'll write down the ones I want to see. And the only one that I really, really that attracted to was a band called Spires. They're a group from Glasgow. And they had a song that I was just like obsessed with. And then And I went to see them at a really crappy bar. It's like the worst venue I've been. I mean, I was a teenager once, and I did go to a lot of shows when I was working in college radio. But like, I forgot how crappy those venues are.
Oh, yeah.
They're the worst way to listen to music. Mm. Like, you have to be so excited for other reasons. If you're just there for music, it's a total waste of your time. Like, but the sound was bad. The PA system was broken. But the performance was fantastic.
Oh, that's okay. Awesome.
And it was funny because they were, you know, it was their first showcase in America, and they were apologizing for all the technical problems.
Oh, sure.
And you know, it's a South By thing, so it's not like their fans are showing up.
Yeah.
Right. But like, I was one of their fans. yeah. So I recommend that. We'll put a link to the music video for a song of theirs called Money, which is really, really cool. It's a neat band. Like, I've learned in the past couple of years that my thing is rock bands with female vocalists. Like, that's like my thing. Mm. All the new bands I've been listening to in the past 5 years are all that. Interestingly, and it might be an algorithm thing, right? The things that you recommended to me.
Yeah.
But what's cool about them is they have two vocalists, and they both sound very similar to each other.
Oh.
In a way that, like, you know, they were just friends growing up, and that's why they started a band. Like, otherwise, if there's two vocalists, you'd want them to sound a little differently.
Yeah.
So that was kind of interesting because you listen to the song, you don't realize that at first, but then you start listening and you hear the subtle differences, and they do a lot of, like, not so much harmonizing, but like chorusing. Mm. And it really makes a very unique sound, actually, is two singers who sound similar. I don't know. I was struck by that.
That's cool.
So we'll put that in the show notes. I was really excited about that. I would love on the show talking about a new band I like, even though I know for a fact people are like, that is not what we listen to this program for.
We talk about a lot of stuff on this program. We don't. That is a game dev related. It's K. We talked about a $200 teapot at the top of the show. It's fine.
I mean, caffeine fuels game dev.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You better produce some really awesome stuff, Stephen, for $200 teapot. This is so bringing you back to the topic before we go to the lure. Yeah, that's a lot. We have so many links.
Yeah.
The show notes for this are going to take like an hour to put together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Cool.
And this is in lieu of doing a whole South By special because I think that's the learning I got from it. It's like, I'm glad I went. I was able to report some interesting stuff. I mean, just the Intel talk and the FCC talk and the design thinking talk, like those three alone was like, I'm glad I got to talk about that on the show. And we'll see next year if they're worth going. Because it doesn't seem like, I mean, I talked for a whole hour on this, but still doesn't feel like a full episode.
A lot of cultural content, but like very game-specific content. You said it wasn't really great, but...
Yeah, and in the future, I'll have less to say about the conference itself, just about the things we see. So we'll have even less to talk about, really, going forward. But maybe the program will be different next year. It'll be worth something to go to. So we'll see. We'll see. Yep. We'll see what next year looks like.
Cool.
Yeah.
I don't think people understand what we have on Patreon, so I want to just touch on that.
Yep. Okay.
The main thing is, the big thing is, it's not the only thing, the big thing is, we have ad-free episodes.
That's right.
Yeah.
This part of the show, in the middle here, you will hear some ads after this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, usually, yes.
But on Patreon, you don't hear those.
No. Right. No, it's just goofs the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And game stuff. Goofs and game stuff.
Goofs and game stuff.
Put that on the billboard.
Yeah.
And no ads for whatever, I mean... It's like dynamic ads. I don't even know what ads you're hearing. It's very specific to you and where you are and what you like. But sometimes, you know, you don't need to be told where you are and what you like. And that's the time where you can go to Patreon and listen to ad-free episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We also have a bunch of other stuff, like more GDC content from, you know, the adventures you guys had, 2024 GDC. Mm-hmm. And a whole bunch of things from past years where we put stuff up there. And again, no ads, because no one loves ads. No one was like, I love ads. Said no one ever.
Yeah, no one says that.
I mean, I'll look into that, but I think you're right.
It's a hypothesis. If you want to do the research, then.
If you love ads, sign up for our Patreon and you can send us a message letting us know how much you love them.
Yes.
If you know what we could do as a piece of Patreon content that would be hilarious is just a bunch of silly ads.
Maybe if we get enough Patreon.
You know, listeners who are on the Patreon may not have heard this, but we have done a couple of host read ads, mm-hmm. and that we do little skits for them, and they're like, they're still ads. Yeah. Maybe we compile those and put them on the Patreon.
That's not a bad idea.
For people
actually.
Who haven't been able to hear them.
Those are real ads, though. I was thinking fake ads.
Oh, I see. Oh, see, you want us to just become a sketch comedy troupe.
A little bit, for a day.
Okay.
If you want to stop this from happening, go to patreon.com/nicegamesclub.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, my topic is Dragon's Dogma 2. Not really, but I just want to talk about Dragon's Dogma.
You've been threatening this for a little bit.
Yeah, and I'm going to continue to threaten it, because the next time we have a roundtable, I'll probably talk about Dragon's Dogma 2. It's just, I've played it a lot.
Yeah.
I've played it over 100 hours.
Wow.
It's only been out a month.
That's wow. As much as I played that solitaire game.
Yeah, right? That's what I'm saying.
That is a lot.
Yeah, it's a whole lot. It's only been out a month. If, for context, like, I put the Sea Incorporated last year. I put that in my Nisus 2023.
Yeah.
And I've played that for 150 hours, which is a lot of hours, but it's been out for a year.
Yeah.
So, yeah. but the reason, the actual topic is about player friction. There were a lot of people who, like, started playing Dragon's Dogma 2 and, like, bumped up against a bunch of the things that are, like, in a lot of specifically open world games, but just games in general, that aren't in Dragon's Dogma 2. So a couple of things, like, fast travel is expensive and limited. You can't just instantly go to where you need to go. You have to, like, you either have to buy this object that allows you to do it, and you can only travel to specific locations on the map. You can get on an ox cart and pay for that, and it's really cheap, but, like, sometimes it fails and you get attacked, and then you have to still walk the rest of the way. Mm-hmm. It's a whole thing like that.
Sounds really fun so far.
It's very fun. you have to physically be on the location to fill up the map. You can't just go up to a fancy tower and do the little skydive like Assassin's Creed or whatever it is.
Or everything else.
Yeah, or everything else. There's only one save file. You can't really save Scum. Well, you can kind of save Scum, but it's very difficult. Or it's just very inconvenient to do it. There's, like, a whole bunch of those kinds of things that, like, add up to effectively what people have coined as player friction. It's effectively, like, the way that I would define player friction is things that are in the game that bump up against what the player wants to do in order for the game to function as a whole better and well. So I think a lot of the core of Dragon's Dogma and Dragon's Dogma 2 is the travel. A lot of the engagement is just walking between roads and getting attacked by a bunch of goblins. And then getting attacked by a griffin, and then getting attacked by a drake. Like, it's a whole bunch of that stuff. And deciding how you want to approach these battles. Or if you don't even want to approach the battles, you can just run away. Like, those kinds of things. And, like, having to manage your resources as you're traveling between these different towns, or to get to your quest, or this cave, or whatever it is. I think that's a big core of Dragon's Dogma. And in order for... basically, fast travel bumps up against that. Like, if you could just fast travel everywhere, you'd never need to actually travel on the roads, in which case you'd never fight anything, in which case then there's barely any game.
That's kind of my problem with Spider-Man 2, is the fast travel was so fast and good in that game that everything got real small.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it makes the world feel... Actually, frankly, Dragon's Dogma, both of the games, have fairly small worlds compared to, like Spider-Man. But it feels a lot larger... Well, most of the time, until you get, like, really high leveled, and then everything just dies really fast. it feels a lot larger when you're just, like, actually traveling in each place, because, like, it takes you some time.
Yeah.
Like, literally in the world and in the game and in real life. And so, like, in order for that to work, though, you have to like, limit the amount that the player can do some of the stuff that they're used to, some of the stuff that is convenient for them. So, like, I guess I wanted to talk about, like, that kind of idea, because I think that, like, I feel like design in general has kind of leaned towards making things more and more player friendly, sometimes to the detriment of the game. And that's kind of hard to say, because, like,
gamers have had it too good for too long.
Honestly, not exactly, but, like, I just think that, like, there have been a lot of instances of things that have, like, that are traditionally done in games now that aren't necessarily right for the game. And I think that, like, you always want to, when you're approaching a thing, we've been talking about this a lot during the show, episode, really. When you're approaching a thing, you want to be you want to make sure you're thinking it through. You don't want it because every decision you make is a decision. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that you're thinking through why you're doing this, and it's not just because this other game did it and it seems like it's fine, I guess. I guess putting y'all a little bit on the spot, are there games where you felt like there were things that were convenient to do? Well, you brought up Spider-Man and how you could fast travel a bunch. And it feels like that, especially with Spider-Man, that seems strange to me because like...
You already travel pretty fast.
Yeah. Well, you already travel really fast and people love the travel. I am the only person on this earth who does not like the travel.
Right. But, well, what it is there are random encounters in Spider-Man,
which
are just random crimes that show up. And they show up on your radar.
Mm-hmm.
And but when you can fast travel anywhere, you end up having to seek them out.
Oh, okay.
In a way that kind of breaks the game a little
bit
for me. Okay. You don't just stumble onto an arson or a robbery,
which
like any good Spider-Man, it's like, that's a great Saturday afternoon. But like in this game, you're going somewhere, you're fast traveling, and then the thing pings, and then you have to turn around and travel to the thing. It feels kind of like not what they intended.
That's really weird too, because like Spider-Man is like half of Spider-Man's things are like patrol, right? Like
that's a good point.
Half of the stories. It feels counterintuitive to it. So I guess this is the kind of example I'm talking about. But like people expect fast travel, and people would be I think people would be upset if like it wasn't as convenient as it is in the game. And it frankly they did fast travel well, partly because it's on the PS5 and like you can load really quickly and it's very convenient in that way. But I think it sounds like it came at the expense of the experience. To a little extent.
I think the PS5, there was a bit of a mandate to like show off the fast loading. Which is something also Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart had.
Yeah.
But they used it. They used that mandate because it was a launch title.
Yeah.
They used that mandate to better effect.
Yeah.
With sort of portals.
Yeah.
Rather than making just the worlds load fast. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I think they got away from making that too easy.
Yeah.
By having those things and that became part of the gameplay.
Yeah.
But I think we talked about in a previous episode on skill trees.
Yes.
We talked about something similar. I think I complained about Mario and Rabbids Kingdom Battle, how you could respec and it really that was so frictionless that it took away a lot of the meaning of that stuff in a way that like is fine, but then it just ended up not being a fun part of it.
Well, because then your decisions don't matter. You can just change them at any point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's meant so that you can make decisions more freely, and that is a good thing, right? You don't want the choice paralysis.
Right.
So, I mean, it's the problem. Just adding friction doesn't solve your problem. It also creates problems.
Yeah, yes.
But, absolutely. You know, you gotta find the balance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Ellen, to put you on the spot, is there a game that you feel lost something due to the conveniences that the game added?
Oh, gosh. It's so hard because those conveniences let you skip over stuff.
Yeah.
They don't, like, friction or, like, having some kind of challenge is what makes it memorable, right? So, like, if you're removing some of that challenge, then...
Right.
I guess one interesting thing that actually kind of runs counter to this is, like, in Breath of the Wild, you have this huge world... And you start out by just running and it takes forever. Mm. And then you get this horse and the horse goes fast.
Yeah.
But then there's all this amazing, interesting like experience and gameplay around the horse.
Yeah.
And there are ways that you can warp from region to region. But I would often decide not to do that because it was so much fun just to ride the horse around.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I had different horses. I had a really fast horse that, you know, like, it would take me four times as long to get from one place to the other because I wasn't warping. Mm-hmm. But I had a lot more fun doing it. And I guess that's the thing that I actually remember isn't a game that gave me like the ability to warp around, but a game that gave me the ability to warp around when I didn't use it.
Well, I mean, that's interesting too, because like I think that's, well, I suppose it's not an example of player friction. I mean, because like you had the option to do both things, but I think it's an example of the game giving you an option to do that, but like it's not an appealing option just due to the fact that the travel was more interesting and you opted out of it. I remember when I was playing Forspoken, like I did the same thing. I didn't use fast travel really up until like I decided to do Achievement Hunt, which was a terrible experience. This wasn't a terrible experience. I just don't like achievements. But anyway.
Betrayed your own philosophy there.
I did. But I just really wanted to keep playing the game.
Yeah.
And
wasn't it cool that there was a mechanism by which you could enjoy yourself doing that?
Whatever. We could talk about it in another episode. Anyway. I didn't use fast travel up until it got tedious for me to get from place to place, because I did all of the stuff and I was too high leveled and nothing was a challenge or interesting, and I just wanted to get the stuff done. And at that point, then I felt like, I didn't feel like the game failed me. I guess I felt like I was failing my experience.
Right.
At that point. But that's not really an example of player friction, because like I always had the option to fast travel. I just never did because I like traveling too much. Or regular travel too much. But Dragon's Dogma forces you to do it. And other games, well, most games don't, I guess. Most games allow you to fast travel. But like it just makes it inconvenient, because sometimes they'll like put fast travel points in locations that make it difficult for you to get to where you actually want to go.
Yeah. So it's an option, but it's like, it's a more interesting choice.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. You have to kind of go out of your way in order to get to your way. And sometimes you just don't want to be bothered. And instead you just drag your fast horse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's a bunch of different ways of going about it, I suppose.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess I wanted to bring that up, because it was something that like, I've seen gamers complain about with Dragon's Dogma 2. And I guess I find that the game is precious to me, so I'm a little more defensive about it than I probably should be.
Yeah.
But I found people were like bumping up against a lot of intended design things. And to be fair, it's not the player's job necessarily to think through their design decisions to understand why they made this thing. They could just play the game and be like, oh, this doesn't work the way I want it to and I don't like it. And that's fine.
You know what, though?
Oh.
I will say that if the game is doing its job,
yes,
the player should appreciate that.
Yeah.
They, you know, they're going to be ignorant to the design decisions that go into it, and they're not going to understand the benefits. And gamers will always have like genius ideas they don't realize wrecks everything, right?
Yeah.
That's not their fault. Absolutely
right.
Not.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say, in that case, that friction isn't, you're describing a friction that prevents a problem, right?
Yeah.
But the friction should also, at its, you know, best case scenario, produce satisfaction, right?
Yeah.
It should be, people should, and so those complaints would just naturally, should naturally come up less.
I mean, it depends, I think, because like it depends on what thing is that it is being bumped up against.
Sure, sure.
Like if you're used to a certain convenience in most games and this game decides not to do it and it's not, then like it feels like, well, it feels like this game is not a modern game. And frankly, Dragon's Dogma 2 is not a modern game in a lot of ways. So I can't.
So they're right.
So they kind of are in a lot of ways. But like it's intended. Like they made these decisions. And they made these decisions 15 years ago.
So you're saying it's not the job of the developer to worry about the influence that all the other games will have on a player's mind.
So I don't know that I necessarily think that like developers don't need to cater to like what other people are doing in the market, I suppose. But I think that, I do think that like it's something you should take into consideration, because other developers have made the decisions for their various reasons.
Yeah.
And if they're all making a lot of common decisions, then like you should take note of that, I suppose. But you shouldn't necessarily just be like, if everybody's doing it, I should do it too.
Yeah.
Because then you're jumping off of a bridge.
Well, you need to have a deep understanding of why your game is built the way it is,
right?
And so if you're going to follow those conventions, you should understand why they are conventions and why you're following them.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
If you're going to deviate from those conventions, you should also understand why they're conventions and why
and that people aren't going to be ready for that.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That will create some friction from players. And I think that it's just helpful to note that.
And not the friction you're talking about.
And not the friction I'm talking about. Yeah. That's true. But, you know, it, either way, just, I guess, ultimately, just be aware of what you're making. As always, that's the goal. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I wanted to bring it up because it was something that I've been recently thinking about, because, again, Dragon's Dogma 2 is the only game I've played will be playing for the rest of my life, I guess. yeah.
I guess we can dig into it a little bit more, right? Like, I talked about how there are conventions. That's just, like, the patterns that people who are making a specific type of game are following.
Yeah.
And you should be aware of those conventions and understand why they are conventions and then make decisions about whether your game should follow them or not. But I did want to hear a little bit from you guys about like how, you know, what are benefits and risks of deciding not to? Because it seems kind of like the fast travel thing specifically, I can understand why it's a more controversial decision,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, because it is a convention. It's a pretty standard convention. Some of these games have a lot of content, yeah. and it can be really frustrating if that content is like very spaced out and it's not necessarily embedded into the world. Well, then yeah. the world just becomes something to get through.
Yeah.
And if your world is still something to get through, but you don't have fast travel, and I'm not sure if Dragon's Dogma was built that way, but then I could see that being really frustrating.
Yeah. Well, Stephen, you talk about the actual, you know, a square acreage of the world is smaller.
Yeah, compared to other.
Mm-hmm. Which is, sort of makes it less frustrating, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it seems like fast travel is really a response to sort of the overindulgence of the size of an open world.
Yes.
Which itself serves a more of a quality of immersion, right? You want to be able to see over the horizon so that you feel that it's big. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it's actually big is actually a problem.
Yes.
And so fast travel solves that.
Right.
But then, yeah, so it depends on a lot of the qualities that you're working with.
Yeah. And so I don't know how best to answer your question, Ellen, but I think that like I think it's just like difficult to say one way or the other. It really just depends on the core of your game.
Yeah. Okay.
I think that like player friction can add something to the game in that the player is sort of bumping up not just against the game but also against the developer. Hmm. Ultimately, games are conversations between player and developer. So, when you're adding that friction, you're telling the player, "I'm adding a little bit of challenge, a little bit of challenge that is inconvenient specifically, not just like a hard boss battle, but like." Something that feels a little off in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And you're challenging the player to get past that.
Yeah.
Or ignore it or handle it in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
In order for them to progress further and understand the game better.
Yeah.
And feel the experience more in certain ways.
I guess that makes sense. I guess the way that I'm thinking about what you said now is, you know, friction is another feature that you can play with, and
yes.
so you can if you think about it as something you can cultivate in a game as a designer, then you can also think about different ways that players might respond to that friction.
Right.
And as long as those choices are interesting, mm-hmm. then it might have a place in your design.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I do think that like just you know friction in general can turn people off from a game.
Yeah.
In some ways, and like, that's fine too, because like not every game is for every person. So I wonder if horror in general is a form of player friction that is just generally well accepted. That's a weird thought, but like, you know, being scared, I don't like being scared. So yeah. It's immediately something that I'm like, nope, no, I don't want this. But I think a lot of people enjoy that, even though it is an aspect of a game that they, you know, actively fear. Right. So I wonder if that's an example of player friction that is generally accepted because it's a necessary part of the game.
That is interesting. It's baked into the expectation that in a horror game, you're going to have moments where you're like, wow, I know something bad is down this hallway.
Yeah.
But also my goal is down this hallway.
Yeah.
I need to go down this hallway. I need to spend 5 minutes psyching myself up to go down this hallway or gearing up to go down this hallway. Or I need to be ready so when the alien comes out of the side passageway, I can run or I know exactly where I'm going to hide. You know, mm-hmm. like, and those moments are really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But they are built around the idea of like this tension between these two reactions to the situation in the game.
Yeah. I think that might, I mean, this is probably a good place to end it because it fans it out.
Yes.
Because you were talking about like how friction is different than challenge.
Yeah.
But I think maybe because of the way you think about horror games, other people probably think of that. I don't know what's around the corner. They think of that more of a risk reward scenario. They think more in traditional gameplay terms. Even if it does, you know, the emotion is, you know, the misses.
That's fair.
So I think that's where it becomes, it starts to get fuzzier and fuzzier as it widens out. What's friction and what's mechanic? What's gameplay?
My view of horror games is very skewed. So
yeah.
So it's understandable, but I'm maybe not getting it right.
But I guess what that reveals is that the friction you put in, I mean, everything is everything, right?
Yeah.
Like it is part of your design, right? It's not, you're not making, it's not a quality of life feature. It's a gameplay decision.
Yes, right? Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. This could spiral off in several different directions. Maybe we'll pick one of the directions to talk about on a different topic.
That's our show. For show notes and so many links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and the large Hasbro Collider. Reply on the various platforms or email us. contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon, as we mentioned earlier. Support the show and get stuff, including those ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be looking at good work cultures with Chris Bergman of Guiley Games. But that's it for this week.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Oh, sorry.
It's not too late to recover. It's not too late to recover.
From Noble Robot.
It's too late to recover.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.